This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello and welcome to This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca and podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network as well as on iTunes. The best interviews, headlines, and music from the past week's daily shows here on Vancouver Co-op Radio every morning at 7 a.m. Media Mornings. On today's show, we're excited to go in-depth into the Egyptian uprising. As you know, on Wednesday, the military deposed President Mohamed Morsi, the country's first elected president, in the wake of potentially the largest protests in world history, 33 million people on the streets of Egypt calling for his ouster, as well as a petition for his impeachment that reached over 20 million signatures. We'll speak with Sarah El-Tantawi, a professor of comparative religion and Islamic studies at University of California, Berkeley. We'll also speak with Melina Lubicon-Massimo, member of Lubicon Cree First Nation in Alberta, and climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace Canada, about this weekend's Tar Sands Healing Walk, which is attracting hundreds of people to Fort McMurray area to pray for the healing of the oil sands pollution. As well, Clayton Thomas Mueller, the campaigner for Sovereignty Summers with Idle No More and Defenders of the Land, as well as the Polaris Institute co-director of Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign, will speak about the Sovereignty Summer program. And finally, Joey Hartman from the Vancouver District Labor Council will speak about the Bill C-377, a union bill about disclosing finances that was defeated by the Senate and sent back to Commons this week. We'll find out why unions were so opposed to it.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.
First, we'll be right back with this week's top news headlines. That is the sounds from Tahrir Square in Egypt on Wednesday night. Amidst possibly the largest popular demonstrations in the world's history, an estimated more than 30 million people taking to Egypt's streets in the past week, and more than 20 million signatures on a petition to impeach President Mohamed Morsi after he expanded his executive powers, altered the constitution, and was accused of tampering with the independent judiciary. Supporters of the President Morsi were killed by gunfire as a crowd of several hundred tried to march towards the military barracks in Cairo, where he is believed to be held. According to The Guardian, supporters of the ousted President Morsi still reeling from the coup that removed their leader from power. Many in the streets saw Morsi's removal as the continuation of Egypt's 2011 Arab Spring Revolution, but the ex-president's Islamist allies viewed it as a coup and a betrayal of democracy by the military. On Wednesday night, the army shut down five TV channels. While there was factional fighting in Alexandria that killed at least three people, dozens of others have reportedly been killed across the country. Police raided the offices of the TV network Al Jazeera and has put out arrest warrants for at least 300 of the members of the Muslim Brotherhood, Morsi's party. We'll go to this clip from Al Jazeera reporting from Egypt.
Finally confirmed that the military was back in charge after staging a coup d'etat. Tahrir Square, the scene of Egypt's revolution little over 2 years ago, erupted. Once again, a movement sparked by the country's youth has led to the overthrow of a leader. Protests organized by the Tamarod movement had been calling for the country's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, to go for days. And demonstrators listened where they could to hear the Minister of Defense, who was flanked by political, religious and social leaders, announce Morsi was no longer in power.
This roadmap includes the following: suspending the Constitution provisionally. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Constitutional Court will declare an early presidential election. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Constitutional Court will run the state's affairs in the interim period and until a new president is elected.
But in Nasser City, where supporters of Mohamed Morsi had gathered in their thousands, there was anger and frustration. Many here, after hearing Morsi was out, swore an oath to protect their country. Morsi's whereabouts are not known, but in an audio address to his supporters, he said a full coup had taken place against him and the people. Several senior members of his Muslim Brotherhood party have been arrested, and arrest warrants issued for many others.
These people who took to the streets are here to prove that their first experience of democracy in Egypt is threatened at birth by the military coup against the constitution.
This latest crisis has gripped, divided and hurt Egyptians. And those divisions were played out violently on the streets of Alexandria. Egypt's army, which has maintained a grip over the country since 1952, made its presence felt on the streets and in the skies.
And that was Al Jazeera reporting from Egypt. Meanwhile, in other Egyptian news, Human Rights Watch says that at least 91 women have been raped over the past 4 days in Tahrir Square, a central site of the recent mass protests that have shaken the country's political leadership and toppled Morsi from power. The New York-based rights group reported on its website that attacks were perpetuated by mobs in the square and called on Egyptian authorities to address what it called a climate of impunity in the country when it comes to cases of sexual violence. The string of alleged attacks highlight the failure of the government, Human Rights Watch said, to face up to the violence that women in Egypt experience on a daily basis in public spaces. The United Nations has also called attention to the violence. On Monday, a spokesperson for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued a statement following reports of protesters being killed, injured, and sexually assaulted. Now in federal Canadian news, halfway through Prime Minister Stephen Harper's majority mandate, more than 40% of Canadians approve of the Conservative government, but only 30% say it deserves to be re-elected. According to a new poll by CTV News and Ipsos Reid, 30% feel the Harper government has done a good job and deserves re-election, but 70%, the vast majority, feel it is time for a different party to take over. The results could be troubling for the Conservatives ahead of their 2015 election. Before the last election, only 44% of those polls indicated the government under Harper deserved re-election. While the majority of Canadians don't believe the Conservatives deserve a fourth mandate, the poll also showed that the party and Harper seem to have weathered the Senate expense scandal storm, with an approval rating that has not dropped since the scandal began. Now in Alberta, hundreds of activists, including Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein, traveled into the heart of Canada's oil sands this weekend, not to protest the destruction of the local environment, but to pray for the healing of land and people. Scheduled for Saturday, The Guardian reports that Native elders from all over North America are leading participants past lakes of tailings wastewater and massive infrastructure on the oil sands industry along the Athabasca River in Fort McMurray, Alberta. Organizers say the event, dubbed the Healing Walk, is an annual spiritual gathering focused on the healing the land, air, water, and all living things harmed by the expansion of what is already the world's largest industrial project. There are plans to triple the size of the oil sands over the next 2 decades. An international science panel recently warned that nearly 200 square kilometers of toxic wastewater is the biggest threat to the Athabasca and Mackenzie Rivers, a region they called Canada's Serengeti. Now over to New Brunswick, where the Sacred Fire Encampment in Elsipogog First Nation has now entered its fourth week. United in their protest against SWN Resource Canada's seismic testing for shale gas fracking, the Sacred Fire has drawn together a wide swath of the population, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous. According to the media co-op, off-record sources close to talks currently ongoing between the Assembly of First Nations and SWN Resources confirmed that the Texas-based company had resumed its controversial seismic testing in Kent County, New Brunswick this week. The source confirmed that SWN will focus its efforts on Line 5, a seismic line west of Highway 126. And the Sacred Fire Encampment says that it remains resolute in its stance against shale gas exploration. In a statement, AFN National Chief Sean Atleo expressed his support for Indigenous people's right to free, prior, and informed consent over resource development. He said he stands with the citizens of Elspgog First Nation and neighboring communities in their assertion of Indigenous rights to the peaceful protest of shale gas exploration and development. Now, in BC news, a BC couple accused of trying to detonate pressure cooker bombs during Canada Day celebrations in Victoria have been described by a friend as former street punks who found Islam, but then exhibited increasingly odd behavior before they were kicked out of a Surrey mosque. CBC News reports that John Nuttall, in his late 30s, and Amanda Cordy, late 20s, are alleged to have turned ordinary pressure cookers into improvised explosive devices filled with rusted nails, nuts, bolts, and washers. The couple's landlord said on Wednesday morning he thought the couple had very limited resources and questioned how they could have financed the alleged bomb plot at all. A friend of the suspect says she doubts they could have acted alone and believes someone else must have been involved. Meanwhile, the Georgia Strait reports that in the wake of police announcing they foiled the alleged plot, some security analysts are asking serious questions about the relationship between two alleged BC terrorists and law enforcement agents. A UVic expert on international security, Scott Watson, said the RCMP statements on July 2nd indicate that officials were likely in contact with Nuttall and Carity, the two Surrey residents allegedly involved in what police said was an Al-Qaeda-inspired plot. However, when pressed on the question of whether officers had posed as collaborators in the attempted attack, police agent Wayne Rideout said with a laugh, "It is very difficult to discuss actual techniques. The devices were in very tight control." An SFU political scientist, Stuart Farson, said that the anti-terrorism operations in the U.S., which often involve undercover agents impersonating terrorists, have always had a problem with entrapment. In July 2011, U.S. magazine Mother Jones published the results of an 18-month investigation of 500 terrorism charges. Nearly half of those prosecuted involved use of police informants, 158 could be characterized as sting operations, and almost 50 were plots led by an actual agent provocateur, an FBI operative instigating the terrorist action in the first place. Now over to Quebec. A judge has signed off on a landmark agreement to compensate victims of sex abuse that occurred for decades within a Roman Catholic organization in Quebec. The Canadian Press reports that, while walking away from news crews outside the courtroom, one victim said the grieving could finally begin. The $18 million mediated settlement is the largest in Quebec and lawyers said could be the largest ever in Canada. It was officially enacted as Quebec Superior Court Justice Claude Auclair signed the agreement on Wednesday. Victims will be paid by July 24th, ranging from $10,000 to $250,000, depending on the type of abuse they endured at three Quebec institutions. The Congregation of Holy Cross issued a release expressing condolences for decades of abuse at three Quebec Catholic institutions. Now, south of the border, the United States celebrated its Independence Day on Thursday. Thousands of websites launched a July 4th online protest against the National Security Agency's surveillance programs, revealed to be wide-sweeping and indiscriminate by whistleblower Edward Snowden, who reportedly remains in a Moscow airport. Reddit, WordPress, and Mozilla are among those websites taking part in the Restore the 4th campaign, which live protests also took place in cities across the U.S. Meanwhile, The Guardian reports that Bolivia has filed a complaint at the United Nations over what it called the kidnapping of its president, Evo Morales, whose plane was diverted to Vienna amid suspicions he was carrying surveillance whistleblower Snowden. The country's ambassador to the UN, Sasha Llorente, said the enforced rerouting of Austria was an act of aggression and violation of international law. The U.S. admitted it had been in contact with other nations over potential flights by Snowden. South American nations accused the United States of being behind the extraordinary maneuver, furious at what they regarded as the humiliation of Morales. Morales' plane took off after Austrian officials said Snowden was not on board, but the defense minister of Bolivia later said that Morales had in fact refused entry to the inspectors, and they got only so far as the door of the aircraft. The U.S. has said it hopes Snowden will be returned to its country to face charges of espionage and theft after a string of other countries said they would not accept his application for asylum. On July 4th, in France, a senior government official chastised the U.S. at a July 4th American Independence Day celebration for its wiretapping and surveillance. Now, in Cuba, the U.S. government has refused to stop force-feeding detainees on hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay during the holy month of Ramadan. The Guardian reports that in court papers rejecting a petition by four of more than 100 detainees said to be refusing food for months now, the U.S. said that the feedings provided essential nutritional and medical care and would not interfere with their religious observance of Ramadan, which begins on Monday. Observant Muslims fast daily from sunrise to sunset during the month. Lawyers for Obama said that the public interest lies with maintaining the status quo, and also said that the four men are not considered persons under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and therefore not protected by it. In Bulgaria, the government has officially dissolved Wednesday with the resignation of Prime Minister Boyko Borisov as thousands took to the street to protest against high electricity bills and declining living standards. According to Policy Mike, the country which joined the EU in 2001 remains the poorest member of the Union after a long and troubled transition to capitalism. The first casualty of the ongoing crisis was the finance minister, a well-respected former World Bank official who undertook painful economic reforms and austerity measures which angered many of the country's trade unions and civil groups. And our final story, Human Rights Group has called on China to end what it has called the forced mass rehousing and relocation of ethnic Tibetans. The New York-based Human Rights Watch, in a new report, said the lives had been thrown into disarray after more than 2 million Tibetans were uprooted in the past 5 years. According to Al Jazeera, insufficient compensation, subpar housing, and lack of help finding jobs were listed among policies of the Chinese government. The aim of the program was designed to, quote, strengthen political control over the Tibetan rural population. Since 2009, at least 117 Tibetans have committed acts of self-immolation in China to protest against Beijing's policies. Well, that's our news for this week. We're going to be right back with our feature interview today with Sarah El-Tantawi, Professor of Comparative Religion at Islamic Studies, who's been following the Egyptian situation very closely. And welcome back. On the line with us today, we have Sarah El-Tantawi, Professor of Comparative Religion and Islamic Studies with a focus on political Islam, currently a fellow at University of California, Berkeley, and has been closely following the situation in Egypt. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Well, thank you for joining us. You've been following the Egyptian situation very closely and have quite a number of contacts on the ground there. Could you talk about the latest that you've heard from Egypt? We just covered in our headlines about the military apparently opening fire on some crowds today.
Yeah, well, there are disturbing reports of violence against Muslim Brotherhood members who themselves have taken a very hardline position on the Freedom and Justice Party, which is on the Freedom and Justice Party website, and this is Morsi's party, or the Muslim Brotherhood's party. They have, completely rejected the change of power and believe that Morsi should be reinstated, and Morsi says that he will not give up until he dies. So there's a security situation that's problematic. But I have to say, according to my contacts in Egypt, really the overall mood is one of jubilation, and it's quite different from what we hear in the Western media about what's happening in Egypt.
This is something I wanted to touch on, because reading some great posts on Jadalia and a bunch of other websites, you know, people are outraged that the media is describing this as a military coup, and yet to outsiders, it does seem like that's what happened. So maybe you could talk to why that's a controversial term.
I too share the irritation at the way that the Western press is simply writing simple headlines like army coup in Egypt oust civilian leader. There's a huge factor that is being left out of that analysis, and that factor is the fact that up to 30 million Egyptians went out into the streets, choking an entire country, to demand that Morsi step down. And this is nothing less than a second popular revolution in Egypt in just over 2 years.
Now, those 33 million people that BBC estimated were on the streets, they said that that would make it the largest protest in world history.
Exactly. And to sort of leave out the fact that a third of the Egyptian population went out into the streets, said, we don't want this president. To kind of leave that out and say, well, this is just a simple military coup, is absurd. And it shows such a disrespect to the people and to the concept of people power and to the idea of grassroots mobilization. And it's analytically absolutely flawed. I mean, how ridiculous to say that the army just somehow had the mandate to go. If the army had gone and tried to take power from Morsi's government without the popular will behind them, that would have been a coup, and everyone, including me, would be against it. But what we're reacting to here is the will of the Egyptian people, and it speaks volumes to me that so much of the analysis ignores the will of the Egyptian people.
It's almost like that doesn't matter. I mean, you read, some analysts of Middle Eastern cultures like Robert Fisk or Noam Chomsky, and they often point out that it seems like in the West, we actually don't care what people in the Middle East actually want or think.
Yeah, there's that's for sure. But you know what it is, I think, even more, is that people in power don't care what the grassroots think. I mean, this is the same in the U.S. and in North America. How often do we feel our political pundits and representatives are sort of waking up in the morning every day trying to do what it is that we, the public, want? I mean, this is elitism, and there's a certain kind of elitism in the pundocracy, you know, that people have studied democratic theory and they think that things should go a certain way, and they're really reciting textbook cases to us What these people need to be doing is learning from what's happening in Egypt, not telling Egyptians that they're not conforming to their textbook definitions of what democratic transition looks like. But that would require a level of humility that is often not there.
Now, one of the things that I think is interesting and maybe confusing for outsiders, because it's not just in the Western media, but I've seen people in other parts of the Muslim world who are outside of Egypt who say, well, this does look like a military coup. But I think that maybe there's a different understanding of the military's role in society. I remember during the January 25th demonstrations, despite the government's crackdown on the protests, sending in camels, for instance, or opening fire on demonstrators or throwing rocks, that kind of thing, that the military was often seen as protecting the crowds. And that was something that I thought was quite interesting at the time, because we have a very different impression of what the military's role is here.
I think that's a very important point. Whether or not we find this romantic or appropriate, the Egyptian public, it does not hate their military. The modern history of the Middle East, it cannot be understood without understanding, especially in Egypt, the essential role that the military has played in independence movements and in creating a relative stability in the country. Now, let's not misread this. I believe the revolution of 2011 was a revolution against that military. It was against the military regime in Egypt, and that military regime cannot be separated from Western policy in the region, which since the end of the Cold War has turned on this notion of oil security and Israel, in which keeping these military regimes in place was a central factor. That's what was needed. In fact, the United States paid for the Egyptian army because they signed the Camp David Accord. So Egyptians have already risen up against that order. But what they got, in a democratic election in which there were only two choices, mind you, only two choices, one between the old regime and one for the Muslim Brotherhood. The Egyptians, by a very small margin, went for the Muslim Brotherhood, tried it out for a year, and realized that they were trading military fascism for Islamic fascism, and said no, because in the end, this is an ongoing revolution, and the Egyptians are not going to settle for less. And that is what has happened. Now, whether that doesn't conform to, you know, some ideas about what legitimacy are in the ballot box, I mean, all of these kind of buzzwords, people are not looking at the details of what actually happened. And for me, it's really, in the end, moot, because the Egyptian people have spoken. They didn't ask the pundits. They didn't ask the New York Times editorial page. They didn't ask anybody. They went into the street. They've spoken, and they refused to leave.
I find it interesting that a lot of reports not only leave out the massive protests over the last 2 weeks, but also they only at the footnotes usually mention that the reason that the protests were, you know, that big coalition was formed was because of his changes to the Constitution. Could you talk a bit about what exactly people were so upset by and how Morsi extended his executive powers?
That's a very complicated situation, but starting in November in 2012, Egypt had made a decision to create a new constitution after presidential elections. So a Supreme Constitutional Committee was formed to debate among wide swaths of the Egyptian public to create the constitution. Now, it's very difficult to say exactly what happened, but by the end of the machinations, it was decided that this constitutional court was not representative and was swayed toward Islamists. In other words, you had a majority on this committee that was supposed to draft the constitution represented by Islamist parties. So that was the first problem. Then a quite problematic, in that sense, constitution was drawn up, which did all kinds of things that were counter to the revolution. Among other things, giving the army the final say in their own budget. So in the new constitution drafted by the Muslim Brotherhood, they actually conceded completely to the army, quite contrary to a major demand of the 2011 revolution. And they did this, why? Because the Muslim Brotherhood's primary concern, and this is what we saw out of them in the last year, is to entrench their power and to keep themselves in power. That is the number one, two, and three reason of the Muslim Brotherhood, and this is the problem. So what happened was that they also enshrined in the Constitution a variety of very problematic ways in which the final legislative authority of the country would lie with religious authorities. And it was also very disempowering for minority communities, but not only Christians, but they made reference to Ahl al-Kitab, or the people of the book, so this doesn't even describe atheists or Baha'is. Or anyway, so it was a deeply flawed constitution in terms of substance. The constitutional committee that created the constitution. But then the real disaster was the process by which the President Morsi tried to ram this constitution down the throats of Egyptians. Egyptians wanted more time to take and amend this constitution, and Morsi, on November 22nd, in response to that, issued a constitutional decree saying that, putting himself above the law, saying that the judges could not rein him in, and saying that he wanted to, that he was going to force a referendum on the constitution. Now, the reason this is complicated is because it is true that there are elements of the deep state that are of Mubarak's regime and the other remnants of the former regime that were indeed trying to sabotage the Morsi government and were acting as a block to a lot of their initiatives. I found that whole situation to be very complicated in that sense. And in fact, I wasn't totally against Morsi's move because I thought it was very important to attack the deep state. But now that time has passed, I just see the degree to which the Egyptian population is not behind their vision for the country. And what's secret to me about the Muslim Brotherhood in this past year is that, in my opinion, they just do not put Egypt first. They put their own organization first.
Well, maybe just to wrap up, Sarah, I mean, where do you think this is going? We're seeing yesterday there was the massive protests by Morsi opponents. And then today we're seeing this sort of day of rejection that his supporters have put on, and there's a number of deaths. They have journalists who are being put in jail, including from Al Jazeera. Where do you think this is going? Because, I mean, El Baradei said that, the country could have slipped into civil war if Morsi had refused to leave. Is this a possibility at all, or do you think that people will continue this kind of street mobilization in a way that's going to take things forward?
Quite frankly, I don't think that the Islamists have the numbers of cards necessary for them at this point to create a civil war. I don't think there will be a civil war. I think that it's a dangerous situation now. I think one of the primary focuses we need to have now is to make sure that, number one, Islamists as human beings and as political parties are safe. We need to be closely monitoring these arrests and make, you know, Baradei has made the argument that these are temporary measures to immediately impose security in the country. We know that we can't trust certainly the Egyptian internal security sources to make good on promises like this. So we need to be keeping a very, very close eye on what's going on with Islamists right now. It's extremely dangerous. The other thing we need to be keeping a very close eye on is, once again, the army. I'm praying that it's going to be essentially different this time, that Egyptians have already lived 18 months of army rule directly after the revolution, SCAF rule, which was riddled with problems and quite problematic, and I think Egyptians retain that memory. So for the revolution to move forward, you know, in my opinion, the struggle with the army is one of the deepest and longest ones of the revolution, and it's not going to happen overnight.
What gives you the greatest hope, Sarah? Last question.
The Egyptian people and their absolute insistence on continuing the revolution until they see the country they want to see.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Sarah Al-Tantawi, a professor of comparative religion and Islamic studies at the Focus on Political Islam, currently at the University of California in Berkeley. On the phone with us, we have Melina Lubicon Massimo. She's a member of Lubicon Cree First Nation, as well as climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace Canada. Good morning, Melina.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's an honor to have you on here, particularly since we've played sections of your speech at this Defend Our Coast action last October, and it was very powerful to hear you speaking about your direct impact of the tar sands.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Could you talk a bit about what the Tar Sands Healing Walk is that's happening this weekend coming up?
Yeah, sure. So this weekend we have hundreds of people actually coming to Alberta. It's our fourth annual Healing Walk we've been having every year. It's basically been a way to bring about awareness to the tar sands and the direct impacts that people are facing on the ground. So what we've done every year is we've asked people to come, you know, that maybe haven't been to the tar sands or Alberta, and we've asked people to walk. It's actually more of a prayer walk. The way that it was first kind of devised or begun really was with elders that had asked, instead of doing like a protest or a demonstration, to really do a prayer walk. And do a prayer walk in the four directions and walk with people and pray for the land, really, and for the people that are being impacted. So that's really what we're doing in the tar sands in the next couple of days.
Could you talk a little bit more, because I'm sure most of our listeners haven't heard your personal story, but what is the impact of the tar sands on your own life?
Well, like many people in the north, I was born in the Peace River region, and the tar sands actually has impacted many different regions in the north. It's the Peace region, the Athabasca region, and the Cold Lake region. And so what happens with my family is that we've actually had industrialization and oil and gas and tar sands impact since basically before I was born. It started happening in the late 70s, early 80s, where basically the encroachment started happening in the land, in the traditional territory where my family's from. And so I was basically born into that. And as a young person, saw the land in pretty, you know, pretty pristine condition in the early 80s. But as life goes on and life, you know, the government has basically leased out oil and gas contracts to multinational corporations, it's basically changed a lot. And so now There's a big difference on the landscape. Basically, the water has changed. The air quality is changing. Impacts to wildlife and as impacts to people and my family. One of the major things that we've seen of a major impact is it was an oil spill that happened just over 2 years ago, where it was one of the biggest oil spills in Alberta's history, and people couldn't breathe, and there was. It was hard for people to basically even know what was really happening. And then when we found out after the fact, it was 5 days later, and, you know, we didn't realize that there was a massive oil spill just, 7 kilometers away. And that's why, the children couldn't breathe and in the school, and they had to shut down the school. So, I mean, there's major impacts happening already on the land and to the people. And so the Healing Walk is one of the ways to bring about awareness to these stories.
Now, your nation, the Lubicon, have a long history of fighting for environmental justice and for their rights. I remember hearing in the late 90s about some of their work with Amnesty International, for instance, fighting against the oil flaring. Could you talk about what inspires you personally to carry on this work? And to, I mean, a lot of people say that the oil sands are here to stay and there's not much people can do about it.
Well, I think what inspires me is the fact that seeing and knowing that my family has to live through this day, every day, and that's why I chose to kind of campaign on this for the past 5 years full-time, is just because I know that the impacts are real, and I know that the impacts are there, and like you said, they're not going away. And so if we choose to just kind of go with it, then I think the impacts will be more severe. If we choose to speak out and raise awareness about these issues, I think what we start to see is what we have been seeing in the past, 5-6 years, is that we've seen, people, when I started campaigning, people didn't even know what tar sands was. People were like, tar sands and Jane? Like, they thought it was an actual, the movie, like, they didn't know.
Tar sands and Jane, that's a good idea.
Yeah,
we should make that movie.
They thought that's what they thought I was talking about, tar sand. And like, so now, 5-6 years later, people, from the hard work of many people, people know that this is actually a major issue, and that there's, it's one of the biggest, will be one of the biggest industrial projects on the planet. And why haven't we had this type of conversation in Alberta, first and foremost, but then nationally across Canada and into the States? Like, why haven't we had this conversation of that, the massive switchover from conventional oil to extreme fossil fuel extraction, and the fact that it takes more water, more has more pollution into the air and more greenhouse gas emissions, and that's really why it's called the dirtiest form of oil, is because it has all of these detrimental impacts that we're not discussing. And that's why I think doing this work and speaking out and saying enough is enough is really where we have to go, and why we have to talk to people about it. Because that's why I decided to do this work, because I was like, the fact that I had to go to my master's and to research this, so I could research it day in, day out, and be like, people need to know about this. This is intense. Like, I'm from these impact zones, and yet, it's not being discussed. It's not being communicated to the communities. It's not being communicated to, the general public. And the more and more stuff that I'd uncovered, I was shocked and I was mortified. And, that's what really pushed me to start becoming more vocal about these issues.
Now, of course, the Minister of Natural Resources, Joe Oliver, and the Conservative government have often painted opponents of the oil sands as being extremists or radicals, and yet you have Obama saying that he would block Keystone XL pipeline if it was proven to have to impact on the climate change, and you have a European Union right now declaring that oil sands oil is in fact dirtier than other oil. How do you think this, things are shifting on the international level that might help with the work you're doing?
Well, I think that it's been helpful, with work being done and with the Fuel Quality Directive in Europe, like you mentioned, and Obama, actually mentioning climate change, because we don't hear that coming from politicians here in Canada. So I think it does basically put international pressure on Canada, and that's why in the beginning we chose to really work with international allies, because they brought about awareness in their countries, and doing speaking tours in Europe. Like, I think it really did make an impact. People started realizing, like, oh, wait a minute, Canada is seen, internationally as this ally, this friend, this peacekeeper, all of these kind of old images that Canada is kind of ridden on, and now people are starting to realize, and those kind of false pretenses are falling apart, and people are starting to realize, oh, actually, they are violating human rights, they're violating Indigenous rights. This has been documented in the UN for decades, that they're actually seen on the international scene as, you know, a climate laggard in at the UNFCCC, the UN Climate Change Forum, that Canada's seen as like basically blocking climate negotiations internationally. And so people are now beginning to recognize that Canada is not actually playing its part and not actually becoming, you know, wanting to actually address the issues of climate change, but in fact, you know, blocking or stagnating these climate negotiations that actually need, that actually are, you know, trying to push for countries to stop, you know, greenhouse gas emissions and for countries to become actually responsible to what they're emitting into the atmosphere. So I think we're definitely seeing the international pressure happening because people are starting to recognize and point the fingers at Canada saying, hey, you know what, actually you're not being this responsible, you know, whatever, like, you know, persona or whatever that you're trying to exemplify in the world, you're actually being a laggard.
So are you saying that Canada is perhaps seen as it's itself being a bit of an extremist as opposed to calling its critics that?
Well, I think sometimes it's easier to point the fingers, and so I think it's easy for Canada to point their fingers in other countries and say, you're violating human rights, you're not doing, you know, your due diligence at this, that, and the other. And I think, you know, right now people are quite surprised, and I think under the Harper government, people are quite surprised that this is, you know, this is happening. And so I think, yeah, I think it's definitely something that people are becoming aware of. You know, when I've toured, say, investors in the tar sands or international media, you know, sometimes they'll take me aside and they'll say, this would never happen in our country. You know, this would never happen where I'm from. And so I think people are quite shocked when they see the tar sands and they're saying, this is what, you know, Canada says it's a responsible, you know, country, but yet it's violating the rights of Indigenous peoples. It's not respecting the rights of Indigenous peoples in their own territories. And so I think it's starting to become quite well known internationally.
Now, you know, when you look at the media coverage, often the oil sands are framed as, you know, what are the long-term environmental costs versus what are the benefits to our economy? But the Tar Sands Healing Walk really does put Indigenous sovereignty and Indigenous rights at the forefront of the struggle. Could you talk a bit about what maybe the difference or similarities between those two different approaches and how exactly the oil sands are affecting Indigenous people's rights?
Well, I think, you know, what the Canadian government would like to say is that, you know, it needs to be the economy or the environment. But I think it's just that's like a, you know, false pretense. Like it doesn't really actually have that argument is basically it's in util or what the word is like they're basically saying that the environment somehow, you know, isn't supporting the economy. And I think what we're actually saying is that at the end of the day, if you don't respect the rights of Indigenous people, if you don't respect the rights of Mother Earth, really, that you're not going to have an economy to function on. You're not going to actually even have the ability to run a country or the ability to have all of the things that, you know, I think first world countries assume that they're going to have for long periods of time. But I think what we're seeing is that Mother Earth is not going to be able to sustain what humans are actually trying to live. You know, we're living past our means. And with Indigenous people's rights, it's like there's a difference between the way in which we view, difference in worldview really is that Indigenous peoples are saying, you know, you can't take more than you need, and that's always been a premise. That's what the elders have always said, is that you can't take more than you need. But the way that we're seeing, you know, an economy or basically a quote unquote free market is that you take, and you don't give back, and you take and you expect things to kind of stay the same, or you expect productivity to go up somehow in this kind of market based capitalism that we find ourselves in. We're seeing the changing climate. We're seeing the inability for people to sustain themselves, and the inability for the earth really to provide. And we're really seeing that here. I think in Vancouver it's a bit different, but we're really seeing that here in Alberta. What we're seeing is that the air quality, the water is becoming contaminated. The water is really disappearing from certain areas. We're seeing, you know, people being sick from just breathing the air. We're seeing wildlife disappearing. We're seeing, you know, an extinction of the woodland caribou within our lifetime by 2040 in tar sands regions. Like, we're really seeing a lot of these prophecies playing out in the tar sands, that what people assume that is going to be there isn't going to be there. You know, it's by us taking from the land. I think that's the differentiation between basically what's happening on a global scale. You know, like, we're under these kind of market-based pretenses that say that you can continue to take and we're going to reach productivity. But at the end of the day, if the earth isn't able to really provide these concepts, of these human concepts, we're not really going to be able to live in a world that's going to really be a very good one. You know, we're seeing huge changes. We're seeing floods already in the south here in Alberta. We're seeing, 2 years ago when the oil spill happened, we're seeing massive forest fires, 100 that took hold of the region, that really, you know, were burning out of control in early May, which, you know, isn't even the season for forest fires. So I think we're already seeing those kind of initial changes.
Well, I really wanted to thank you for joining us, Melina. It's an honor to speak to you, and wish you luck with the Tar Sands Healing Walk this weekend.
Okay, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much. That was Melina Lubicon-Massimo. She is Greenpeace Canada's climate and energy campaigner, as well as a member of Lubicon Cree First Nation. We're going to play an interview now on This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFR 100.5 FM, and online at w2media.ca, also on Rabble Podcast Network and iTunes. This is Clayton Thomas Mueller. He is a campaigner with Sovereignty Summers. It's a project of Idle No More and Defenders of the Land. He's also the Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign Corps Director at Polaris Institute, and he was interviewed by Derek O'Keefe last Friday.
Good morning, Clayton.
Hey, good morning, and good morning to all the listeners.
I wanted to start by asking you about the Sovereignty Summer campaign, which you're involved in organizing. Why sovereignty in particular? Because often we talk about Indigenous rights or justice, but there's not always the emphasis on sovereignty. I'd be interested in the political point behind that.
Well, absolutely, and I think that, you know, not to do a shameless promotion of my dear friend Peter Kolchinski's book, but there's a spectacular book that the author Peter Kolchinski wrote titled Indigenous Rights Are Not Human Rights. And I think that term really hits the center of why we launched the Sovereignty Summer Campaign. The discourse here in Canada, you know, and just people's general, you know, rage towards the federal government, especially recently in the last year, with Harper slamming controversial omnibus bill legislation down the throats of Canadians and First Nations alike, you know, these insane pieces of legislation, of course, gutted 30 years worth of environmental laws, oversight, regulatory and enforcement mechanisms. It did all kinds of revisions to the criminal codes of Canada, and most of this legislation, of course, carries a heavy, heavy price and a disproportionate targeting of Indigenous peoples in Canada. And so, you know, the conversation we've been having with folks across the country over the last, you know, over the last while, while we've been developing and getting ready to launch Sovereignty Summer, has been a very real conversation about, you know, grim realities that a lot of the status quo strategies and tactics of social movements in Canada to hold this government accountable have been stripped away. All roads at this point now lead to the Prime Minister's office. Even the National Energy Board, who had federal powers over the decision of national energy projects like the controversial Northern Enbridge Gateway, their power has been stripped away, and final authority to say yay or nay to the Enbridge Northern Gateway and other controversial energy infrastructure projects now lie in the hands of our greedy Prime Minister Stephen Harper. And so the last best effort, the last bastion of legal protections left, not just for Indigenous peoples in this country, but for all Canadians, to stop Harper and the private sector extractive industries and their ridiculous profit schemes, you know, that are coming at us in the form of Canada's Economic Action Plan, is the support, the implementation, the complete unveiling and education of what's known as the Native Rights-Based Strategic Framework. And that is the core of Sovereignty Summer. You know, utilizing a Native rights-based strategic framework, using education, popular education strategies, education campaigns, nonviolent civil disobedience, all of these tools in the Sovereignty Summer Campaign's toolbox are aimed at achieving the six core demands of our campaign, with the number one demand being the repeal of all of the harmful provisions of the controversial omnibus bill legislation that Stephen Harper has brought forward, Bill C-45, Bill C-38, and about half a dozen other pieces of controversial legislation that are currently being, you know, muddled over in the Canadian Parliament.
I wanted to ask you about the Tar Sands Healing Walk. Unfortunately, you covered a lot of ground there, but unfortunately, we only have a few more minutes. But
yeah.
The Healing Walk, is this also an important chance to emphasize the sovereignty of the First Nations peoples around Fort Chipewyan in particular, but other nations as well? Because here in BC, the debate often takes the shape of, you know, we don't want the pipeline crossing First Nations territory in BC, or we don't want it threatening the Pacific coast. But we often forget about the very serious frontline harm that the tar sands are doing in northern Alberta and First Nations people there.
The Keystone XL campaign, which has become the lightning rod of the U.S. environmental movement, the Northern Gateway campaign in BC there, you know, and the Emerging Energy East pipeline campaign, are all part of a never-ending battle against pipeline and refinery proposals by the big oil lobby and petroleum sector. If we don't put our emphasis and focus on stopping tar sands at the source in Athabasca, northern Alberta, you know, we're going to be stuck in these fights for decades. The Healing Walk is the fourth annual Healing Walk. It's organized by the Keepers of the Athabasca. This year's Healing Walk will see hundreds, you know, of people. We've already had over 500 people register for the Healing Walk. Elected leadership, including the Grand Chief Stewart, Philip Stewart of British Columbia's Union of BC Chiefs, Chief Alan Adam of Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein, Winona LaDuke, and probably your neighbor are all coming to this year's Healing Walk to participate in a deeply grounded ceremony to pray for the healing of the land in Fort McMurray that's been destroyed by tar sands industry, to pray for the minds and hearts of those people that are participating in the destruction of said land so that they wake up and become aware of how destructive and harmful their actions are and put a stop to it. And so, yeah, we've got to put a focus on stopping tar sands at the source, because it's the biggest representation of the insanity of our current economic paradigm that is, you know, putting profit before all life on the face of Mother Earth.
Well, that is well said. I wanted to welcome Alfonso Osorio into studio. Good morning, Alfonso.
Good morning, Derek.
And maybe just before we let Clayton go here, Indigenous struggle in the Western Hemisphere, you know, is nothing new. It's 500 years, as our earlier guest Sheila McLean said.
And that was Derek O'Keefe interviewing Clayton Thomas Mueller. He is Indigenous Tar Sands co-director at Polaris Institute, as well as the Sovereignty Summer coordinator with Idle No More and Defenders of the Land. Our final interview today is with Joey Hartman, president of the Vancouver and District Labour Council. She was interviewed by Jane Bowie on Wednesday's program about the controversial anti-union legislation that would have forced the transparency of union finances and political campaigning. We'll find out why the bill was so controversial and why the Senate, even the Conservative members of the Senate, decided to send it back without passing it to the House of Commons. Here is Joey Hartman.
Good morning, Joey.
Hi, Jane.
How are you this morning?
I'm good.
That's good. So I understand that we'd spent a fair amount of time talking over the last while about Bill C-377. That was the bill that would force unions to have all their financial information posted up on websites, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that was defeated in the Senate. Well, maybe not defeated, but amended and sent back to the House of Commons.
That's right.
So can you tell us a little bit about that and what that means?
Well, you know, we had really strongly objected to this piece of legislation at the federal level on the basis that it was really an attack on unions and setting the scene for a delineation of what were unions spending on activities like negotiations and grievances and arbitrations versus what were we spending on international solidarity work, political support, and those other very, very important kinds of investments into workers' rights and civil rights across the country. And the other part about it was that it was only unions that were being asked for this so-called transparency and not things like doctors' associations, pharmacists' associations, other forms of dues-paying organizations, where those dues, again, are tax-deductible to a certain amount. And so, you know, that was one of the things that the government was saying, is because this is a taxation issue, then this so-called transparency is a requirement. So the Senate said a couple of things. One is that it was very badly written, and the other was that they kind of cheekily recognized that the government wasn't prepared to put the same level of transparency rules on itself. So there had been a private member's bill, Brent Rathgerber.
A conservative MP
who actually left the Conservative Party over this. He had put forward a transparency bill for his own government, saying every salary of $100,000 or more should be publicly disclosed. And the government amended that themselves and said, well, no, we think $441,661 is a better number. I'm not sure what that relates to exactly, but it obviously is a threshold that mattered to the government. The Senate looked at that and said, well, if that's the rule that makes sense for government officials, then that's also the rule that would make sense for disclosure for union officials. So they sent it back with that amendment, as well as a couple of other ones that are quite significant. One is that it was originally drafted that all transactions of $5,000 or more had to be disclosed on this public website, and they've amended that up to $150,000. Which satisfies concerns of business, actually, who supply office supplies, et cetera. They were worried about their competitive edge if all of that information was publicly disclosed. And then the third main piece is that it was so far-reaching that even a tiny organization was going to have to do all of this very detailed accounting and disclosure. And they amended it so that only organizations of 50,000 members or more would have to do it. Now, what we don't know is, first, an organization like CUPE, for example, mm-hmm. which has about 500,000 members, where would they fit? Are they expected to disclose for each of their hundreds and hundreds of locals across the country, or would it only be the national organization? So there's still a lot of answers to be found, but the main thing is that the Senate, for the first time in a very long time, has actually done what they're supposed to do, which is to be the sober second thought, to look at a piece of legislation and say, no, this isn't working.
And it's interesting, is it? I mean, it is a conservative majority in the Senate,
mm-hmm.
so it also, I think, reflects some division within the Conservative Party around certain types of issues.
Well, true Tories actually don't like bureaucracy, right? They don't like unnecessary disclosure and bookkeeping and all of this other kind of stuff when it's only happening for the sake of pettiness or politics. And so I think that's what part of what we're seeing. Plus, they also really were persuaded, I think, that if this was passed at the Senate, then the next step was to be fighting it all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada. And their legal people were telling them that that was a failing exercise, and it would cost an awful lot of money and would be seen as a political maneuver on their part to have put it through because it's so flawed. So
it'll be interesting to see what happens when it goes back to the House of Commons.
Yes, it does have to go back, and you know they could look at it and say, we don't care, we don't like your amendments, we're sending it back to you again untouched. Yeah. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So we didn't have you with us last week because you were at the Summer Institute for Union Women in Seattle. Do you want to let us know a little bit about what it was like, and who was there, and what was talked about?
Yeah, it's an educational, like a summer school for women only, and so it's almost exclusively women from the labor movement. Some as well from, there was a labor beat reporter from Wisconsin there, for example. So some other people who are interested in labor but aren't necessarily in unions. And so this is a women-only event that happens every year, and it moves in where it is. So this year it was in Seattle. It's been the year before in Los Angeles. It was one year in Honolulu. And next year it's going to be in Victoria from July 8th to 13th. So that's a little more accessible, perhaps, for some women locally, but it's a school, basically, so you have core courses in the morning and then a whole bunch of workshop opportunities in the afternoon. And so I was there teaching collective bargaining with a really amazing woman from Seattle named Susan Crumpton. There was also courses in how to run for elected office, one on race, gender, and class, and helping people sort of sort through their own analysis and understanding where other people might sit on a spectrum, and moving from beyond tolerance, perhaps, to broader acceptance in some of those issues. There was one on labor law that looked at both Canadian and American labor law as it applies to unions currently. How to be a good leader, a course for young activists, and how to be more involved in that kind of stuff. And then we also did an action, which is always part of the Summer Institute for Union Women, where we went to SeaTac Airport and supported groups of workers, one group for a privatized company that works to do maintenance and security support for airlines that has been trying to get recognized, their union recognized for a long time. And so we chanted outside of the door of the office. The manager refused to come out, but he did accept the petition. And then we went to the desk for the United Airlines check-in and again encouraged them to make sure that their workers have proper health and safety protections.
And that was Joey Hartman, president of the Vancouver District Labor Council, interviewed by Jane Bowie earlier this week. Well, that's our show for this week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca, and now podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network and on iTunes. Thank you for listening. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. See you next week.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.